Todos los miércoles a las 6 de la tarde en Radio Usal. Don de Lenguas. Un espacio realizado por profesores y alumnos de la Facultad de Traducción y Documentación de la Universidad de Salamanca. En Radio Usal, Don de Lenguas.
Muy buenas tardes, estimados oyentes de Don de Lenguas. Hoy os traemos una entrevista especial. Jesús Baigorri, exprofesor de nuestra facultad, ha tenido el honor de entrevistar a uno de los investigadores más influyentes en el campo de los estudios de interpretación, Daniel Gill. Haremos un viaje por su apasionante vida académica y profesional, para terminar hablando de cómo se engendró el famoso modelo de esfuerzos y sobre la situación de la investigación en España, entre otras cosas. Sin más dilación, os dejo con la entrevista.
Buenas tardes, un día más estamos en el programa Don de Lenguas, el programa de la Facultad de Traducción y Documentación de la Universidad de Salamanca. Hoy tengo el placer de contar como entrevistado con el doctor Daniel Gill, una persona que ha trabajado durante muchos años en pro de la investigación y de la enseñanza de la interpretación y al que he conseguido convencer para entrevistar. Professor Gill, good afternoon.
Hola.
We're going to start talking about your background in the field of languages, because it is quite surprising to me to know that you started studying mathematics as your first choice, but then you have become an interpreter and a researcher in the field of interpreting languages. How did this happen?
Well, when I was a child, I traveled with my parents and we lived in a number of countries. And as a child, I picked up languages, more or less. But my primary interest was in mathematics. That's because I was not smart enough to do other things, such as literature, which was very mysterious to me. So I did indeed study mathematics. But while I was studying, I was working as a translator, self-made translator, mm-hmm. because I had to earn my living. And when I graduated and started working as a mathematician, I realized that company life as a mathematician, at least where I was, entailed not very creative tasks. And at that time, I was not worried about having a job. This was a different situation. So I decided to focus again on translation and studying other things. And eventually, I drifted off towards translation, interpreting, and research, because research is a sort of chronic inborn disease.
So you started as a translator, I mean, written translation, rather than interpreting. How did you turn to oral translation?
Okay, at one point I decided to study Japanese, and in third year Japanese we had an introduction to consecutive interpreting class by a colleague who was a conference interpreter. And he identified me as someone who just might have some talent for conference interpreting. So he pushed me towards the door of the other school that was in the same building, which was ESIT, and somehow I got admitted, and somehow I got trapped and addicted and became an interpreter.
But not with the Japanese-French combination, or was it with it?
No, that was French, English, and German.
Mm-hmm. All right. How did you... Where did you study Japanese? Was it in the Oriental Studies Institute, or...?
Well, actually, I started on my own.
Oh, all right.
And I went to the Paris Oriental School, Langzhou, as we call it. And then I went to Japan, yes.
Because there was a tradition in Paris, in Oriental languages since the Middle Ages, actually, notably for the relationships with the Ottoman Empire. But this is obviously the Far East, not the Nearer East.
But it's true, it's in the same tradition. It's still the école, it was the Institut National des Langues et Civilisations Orientales.
INALCO.
Yes.
INALCO.
Yes, that's the one.
Okay. And you went through ESIT, and then you found a job immediately afterwards, or did you start working as a freelancer? Were you a staff interpreter somewhere? Or
I worked as a freelancer for 2 years before I was eventually hired by the South Pacific Commission in Nouméa as a staff interpreter and translator. And then I returned to Paris as a freelancer. And actually, yes, I think that was it. I'm just trying to find the history of events. I don't have all the documents. But and then I went to do some research on a research fellowship in Japan right after I finished a PhD in Japanese. And at that point, they wrote to me and offered me a position as an associate professor at INALCO in the Japanese and Korean department. Uh-huh. And this is when I became an academic.
How was life in the South Pacific?
Wonderful. How many hours do you have for that? It was wonderful. It was addictive, too. The great thing when you work as an interpreter for the South Pacific Commission is that you go to very small countries and you're really part of the team and you talk to people and they tell you about the real needs, about the real life, unlike what happens if you work as an interpreter for organizations in very large countries. Mm-hmm. Plus all the beauties, all the music, the dancing, all the customary traditions, all the cultures of the Polynesian, Melanesian, and Micronesian peoples. That was fascinating.
Yes, because, I mean, for us as Western Europeans, the utopia might be located down there, or paradise might be located down there, as it was probably for Gauguin and for others.
Well, maybe not quite. I didn't quite lead the life of Gauguin and others. Not really. Intellectually, it's very stimulating, but after a few years, you want to communicate more with people in larger countries, with larger circles, I would mm-hmm. say.
So from INALCO, you went onto different higher education institutions? You stayed there for a long time? Or?
Yeah, well, the problem at INALCO was that I was interested in research into translation and interpreting, but not limited to Japanese. And they wanted me to focus on Japanese. So I had to go elsewhere. There was another thing, too, is that institutionally, INALCO didn't have the habilitation agreement, which makes it possible to be qualified to become a full professor. So you had to go, I had to go elsewhere anyway.
And that elsewhere was Lyon?
Yes, the next job was at Université Lyon 2, which was an interesting experience.
As well.
Yes.
But you continued all this time working as an interpreter, right?
Yes.
With the language combination you mentioned before, with German, English, and French, or did you add others? Other languages, I mean.
Well, officially, I only have French and English.
Ah, all right.
I stopped working with German after a few years because at that time, I was interested in interpreting in scientific and technical conferences, medical conferences, things like that. I wasn't interested in industrial conferences. And working for the steel industry and working for various French, English, and German groups was not very interesting to me, and it took a lot of work to maintain my German at professional level. So I think I made a decision rather early on, after a few years, to work with French and English only.
You continued with research, and you started with a work that has to do with a general reflection on how research can be conducted in the field of conference interpreting. Recherche sur regards sur la recherche en interprétation de conférence. What was the importance of this work for your own career afterwards, in the sense of opening new lines of curiosity, scientific endeavors, etc.?
Well, I never thought of a career. I never thought of having an academic career. It just happened. What I do know is that I didn't know it at the very beginning, but that I have a certain type of mindset which leads to research. And I had done a bit of research while studying mathematics. I also studied sociology, but only up to a first degree, and a little bit beyond that, I participated in some research projects. And when I got interested, I always tried to understand things. I don't say I succeed, I just try to understand things. And I got very interested in the hows of interpreting. And I looked for explanations, and where I was at, is it the explanations of Seleskovich, which was the one that dominated the scene at that time, was pretty attractive. But on the surface, once you started digging a bit deeper, there was not enough. So I started looking at the way research was done, and it was not at all in line with what I knew about research. And this led me to further exploration and to find out about other ways of doing research, which, by the way, led to many misunderstandings. People thought that because I was initially a mathematician, I was only interested in quantitative research, that I was only interested in empirical research and disregarded theoretical research. These are misunderstandings. But it is true that I have a certain mindset that was shaped, or perhaps misshaped, by my background. But I explored other things, and I found it fascinating, and I find a lot to say for non-quantitative, non-empirical research as well. So I'm not thinking of my own career, I'm thinking of the developments that have been occurring in the field, both in translation and interpreting research, and I find they're fascinating. But I also think that sometimes we need to warn people about drifting away and believing in the illusion that mathematics or statistics will solve it all.
Mm-hmm. But the truth is that research at that time, both in the field of translation and in the field of interpreting, were quite scarce. I mean, there was very little background. Of course, you have mentioned the dominating paradigm of the théorie du sens, but in fact, there was very little research as such. I mean, it was something that was done as an intuitive, spontaneous trade rather, or occupation rather than profession. And in this sense, the academic or the research that was carried out in a way in this pioneering work of yours was a way to put the profession in line with other professions at that time. Don't you agree with this? Or
I think the real pioneers were people, the psychologists, and people like Barbara Moser and other people. I was lucky enough to be in a sort of intermediate position, having understood what those psychologists were doing, and being able to talk to professional interpreters and professional translators, as well as and being able to see things, to put things in simple language. I think that my own research is not very sophisticated, to say the least. I was lucky to come up with simple ideas that meant something to people and that helped them develop their own things. But really, the real pioneers were other people, not me.
How do you come up with the efforts model? I suppose that was something that you experienced personally in the booth while working, and that you came to formalize in a so-called formula, if you want, which has to do with physics and with the way in which we work with energy and with the way we administer the intellectual or the energy capital that we have at the beginning of, for example, of a conference or of an assignment, whatever it is, and then you arrived at the formalization, which has become famous and which is widely used, I suppose, in many universities, the efforts model.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you should mention that. Perhaps this has something to do with physics, as you said yesterday. I didn't think of it, but maybe there is something in my background, because studying mathematics, you also study physics. There may have been something like that, but I wasn't aware of that. What I was aware of is the fact that there were many errors, many infelicities, even that there were many difficulties, let's say, obvious difficulties, and I tried a way of identifying the problems and perhaps modeling something that will help understand it better in very simple terms. And I think that the beyond the intuition, I think what really helped me was cognitive theories of that time, at that time in the 1970s. And this led to formulation of some things that apparently people found useful. But there are other people who designed much more sophisticated models and who were much more knowledgeable about cognitive science than I was. Barbara Moser is one of them. Robin Setten is another. There are other people. I think they were not lucky enough to have the same influence, perhaps, because the level of sophistication of their models is such that it makes it a bit difficult to connect with, at least with the educational environment. Whereas my own model was, I think it was a bit less simplistic than Seleskovich's model, but still within the reach of students who were not interested in theory, really.
Mm-hmm. When you were designing the model, I suppose you tested it not just in your own interpreting experience, but also while teaching with your students. Was it like that, or?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's not a test in the scientific sense of testing the theory.
No, I understand. Mm-hmm.
It's a way of organizing experience that we know about. The only theoretical part, the really theoretical part, and which is being tested and which so far I think seems to be holding its ground, is the tightrope hypothesis, in spite of what at least one person seems to say. It has nothing to do with the proportion, with the maximum dilation of the pupil, whether we're close enough or not close enough to cognitive saturation. The point is that we're close enough so that even little things will make us stumble and fall. Mm-hmm. Yes, the didactic test is, of course, a classroom experience. You talk to students, you see whether it helps, you see what reactions they are. You see whether the model helps you explain why teachers give them this or that advice, why it makes sense or doesn't make sense to take notes in the source language, in the target language, etc., and whether it encourages students to keep fighting in spite of the fact that sometimes they think, my God, I don't have an A language, all my languages are C or D languages, and I will never make it. And I was very happy to receive comments such as, thank you for your effort models, they encourage me to continue. I thought I wouldn't be able to make it, but now I know that there are reasons for which it's difficult now, and there is hope for an improvement in the future. Mm-hmm. So this is my didactic test of things.
But I guess the feedback, the positive feedback, does not come only from students, but also from fellow researchers.
Yes, I'm very grateful for the generosity of colleagues. This is true.
Mm-hmm. Well, dealing with this model, have you come up with? How would I put it, with the sort of necessary ingredients of an interpreter or a would-be interpreter in order to materialize their desire? Because this is interesting for our students. I mean, what are really the conditions, the sine qua nons that should be met by would-be interpreters?
No, I'm afraid I don't have...
From your experience.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have any answers on the basis of the effort models or any answers on any solid basis. I think it depends on people. There's so much that has been written by people with a lot of experience, with a lot of intuition, and who know the field. I think things are probably different depending on the country as well.
And on the language combination
and so on. The language combination and on the needs of the market. And I mean, you have to know the people. Let's say if you have been educated in a certain school system, let's say the Korean system or the French system or a German system, then maybe the prerequisites that will help you eventually become an interpreter are not quite the same as in another country. And I mean, I don't like to make claims like this as if I knew. I don't really know.
All right. Just a few words about the future of research from your vantage point. I mean,
it's wonderful. I feel encouraged by developments that you know I have been witnessing in the field these past few years. There's obviously more interaction between people. There's obviously more openness to various paradigms, even though there's still people who try to build empires on one paradigm and say this is the only one that's valid, like the experimental paradigm is the only evidence that is valid comes from experiments. True experiments, no. But most people now understand that we have a lot to learn from each other, and I see more and more research being done, including empirical research, more mixed methods, mixed groups, research groups that are springing up. So we do have financial limitations, but there's a lot of development, and I'm much more optimistic than I was.
Since you have been in Weisenheim and you go quite often to the east, I mean to Guangdong or to Shanghai or Japan, etc. Do you see any kind of hybridization between East and West regarding also research, or how do you see this element?
Well, I think this was present from the start. I know that in Japan, for instance, the father of interpreting research in Japan, Kondo Masaomi, who's not really a researcher himself, but who managed through his personality and leadership and interest, of course, to set up a whole group that is prospering, has become very very regular in its activities. He took his inspiration from the West. The Chinese took their inspiration from the West. So in most cases, when we talk about interpreting research, this hybridization has occurred in one direction. Now I'm waiting for it to occur in the other direction. Will we be able to learn what we can learn from the Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans, and other people in Asia who are doing research?
I'm afraid we're running out of time, and just a few words as a final conclusion or a final comment on the situation you perceive in Spain regarding interpreting and interpreting schools.
I'm glad you finally talk about Spain. I'm a big fan of Spain and of that particular group of interpreting researchers that are found essentially in Granada, but around Granada as well. There's a whole network of people. I think from the 90s on, for institutional reasons, there has been more and more research, but the way people interact and a number of personalities, including yourself and including people like Ángela Collados, make this field very, very active, and we have a whole set of PhDs, the latest by Rafael Barranco Droege. I hope he gets his chance in the difficult economic environment here to contribute, because there's really a lot that is being done and that can be admired by everyone.
Thank you, Professor Gil. And hopefully we can continue this conversation one day, probably not here in Granada, but in Salamanca.
Thank you. Thank you very much.